Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This episode is sponsored by Casper. Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/decoding and using promo code DECODING at checkout. Terms and conditions apply.
Be careful what you wish for. For a self-portrait, you may find it's not very flattering.
Enough games, Robert. Good night.
Let's go. You got everything?
Yes.
No, William. I think perhaps one final game.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding Westworld, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Westworld. I'm David Chen.
I'm Joanna Robinson.
Welcome to the show. What we do here on this podcast is we recap every episode of Westworld in detail. We speculate, we theorize, but we do not spoil anything from future week's episodes, and that includes the next time on preview that HBO sometimes shows before the next episode. You can find more episodes of this podcast at decodingwestworld.com. You can also email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. So much to discuss this week. Season 2, Episode 9 is the episode we'll be recapping. Vanishing Point, directed by Stephen Williams. So let's get into it, shall we? But before we do that, we got a couple of announcements. We got a couple of emails we got to go through. First of all, on last week's episode, I said that if you have any names out there that we did not shout out, even though we said we would shout them out because you backed our Kickstarter, please let us know. I said email decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Let us know if we didn't get your name shouted out during the show. And several of you emailed in, and I don't know what happened. Like, there might have been some issue with user error, most likely on my part, or perhaps like the name was not submitted in the way that people wanted it to, or whatever. But we did have some names we wanted to shout out, so I will just shout them out now. Big thanks to Dan Cleland. Big thanks to Nathan Hale Sargent. And a big thanks to Michael Tavares and Tracy Richards for contributing to our Kickstarter. Really appreciate it, folks. And thanks to everyone who donated to the Kickstarter and made this season of the podcast possible. I think that should now cover everyone. But if we possibly still missed anyone, do email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com and let us know. We will be sure to rectify that mistake immediately. All right, Joanna, you had a couple things you wanted to bring up, right? In response to last week's episode, right?
Yeah, just a few like corrections or comments. First of all, I made this mistake on both my Westworld podcasts last week. Good job, me. Which is I misheard something that Akichita said to Ford in last week's episode. He said he found himself a new drive. I misheard him and thought he said a new tribe. Mm. And so we had this whole discussion about what that meant when I misunderstood. The sentiments aren't entirely dissimilar, but dissimilar enough that I got some feedback on it. So
this changes everything.
All your theories are now out the window.
Yes. Everything you said is now intellectually bankrupt because you misheard that word. Anyway.
And then the last thing I will say is that I thought we brought this up, but we got enough emails that either we glossed over it too quickly or whatever. But yes, I think Dave Chen and I are both aware that Zahn McLaren, who played Akichita, was in season 2, episode 2, right? At the sort of pitch meeting for Logan.
Yeah.
So we knew that. I thought we talked about it, but enough people said we didn't talk about it that I just thought I would underline the fact that we know that that's the case. You know, and one emailer said perhaps, I don't know, Logan was talking to him more in the desert than he otherwise would have because he recognized him from that meeting. I don't think so, only because like Akichita was wearing a lot of paint when he encountered Logan in the desert, and Logan does not seem to be like the kind of dude who would know what is what when it comes to Ghost Nation.
Even if he was lucid, he might.
But
not
I was
know.
Yeah. But the other thing is, his mind was completely gone. The information we're supposed to take from the fact that Akichita was in that original pitch meeting with the Angela character and Logan is that he's a very, very old host. But we already knew that. So yeah. There you go.
So, Joanna, there was a complaint I had about last week's episode that I did not voice because, you know, in all of our excitement to talk about how awesome last week's episode was, I had forgotten to bring this up. At least I think I forgot. So let me know if I'm wrong about that. But I think one of the issues I had with last week's episode, which, again, was beautiful and sublime and had a lot of great qualities about it, is there is this principle in filmmaking and also like video game creation, I guess is another way to say it, that you only show the audience what they need to see. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you've ever been on a film set, you know, like 2 feet off of what the camera is shooting, there's like nothing there. You know what I'm saying? Or if you're playing a video game, it often only renders the parts of the level that you are in and are going to immediately interact with. And it did strike me as a little silly that they have all these characters like out living lives and doing all this stuff that's like theoretically is completely unnecessary for the maintenance of the park and to accomplish what it needs to, unless there's some broader plan of like having these hosts, you know, testing out some kind of programming you know, without humans there. Did you have any thoughts on like why they might have these hosts continuing to operate on autopilot even if they're not interacting with guests?
You're talking about Ghost Nation?
Ghost Nation or any hosts at all, you know?
I think there's a potential for all of the hosts to interact with guests, because though guests are kept on certain paths and loops, they're also like the whole idea of spontaneity of play is that they should be allowed to go anywhere within reason. And mm-hmm. So I don't know that we were supposed to take from all this that Ghost Nation never encountered any guests this whole time that Akichita was out there. And in fact, Akichita, you know, intentionally sort of goes into some places where there are more guests than there might otherwise be. So I don't know that there's anyone like living in a corner of the park that like no one has seen except for Akichita, who went to like great pains to make that the case. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I would say it's an extremely minor nit. So, you know, but I just, I would feel remiss if I did not mention it.
If you didn't pick it.
Yeah, I would feel like something is wrong. Like there's some part of me that was unexpressed if I didn't say it on the podcast.
Fair enough.
But I think I would also say that like in that scenario, if like, it seemed like Akichita and his, colleagues were in a really remote part of the park is what it felt like based on how it was shown on the screen. And that like theoretically, like they wouldn't, you know, there'd probably be some way to program it so they wouldn't animate until a human interacted with them. You know what I'm saying? Just to like save energy and stuff. Anyway, right. Completely minor. And I probably am going to regret bringing it up, but there it is.
I like when you pick nits mostly. There might be one in this episode that I will fight you on. But
okay, no,
part,
we're definitely going to fight a lot in this episode of the podcast. Okay. I'm really looking forward to that. Okay.
Okay.
So we got a couple emails from people. Suzanne wrote to us about Sam Shepard, right? This email we want to talk about.
I mean, she mentioned Sam Shepard because we were talking about Ed Harris and the right stuff on another podcast of mine, but mostly she was writing in about creation myths,
yeah,
which I thought was interesting. We talked a lot on this podcast this season about biblical imagery in the season, like, you know, sparked by the thing opening with the flood. And then all these like messianic sort of imagery of like who is our Christ figure in this season, all that sort of stuff. But Suzanne brings up a good point and something I think we touched upon last week when we were talking about Kichita's journey to the underworld being a myth that's repeated across different cultures. And she brought up the fact that like when it comes to creation myths, a lot of different cultures have similar markers. So a flood is just a really common thing in across almost all mythology. So the Native Americans have a creation myth that involves a flood, Celtic tradition, Babylonian stories. And she points out the Babylonian story includes the word Sweetwater as part of it. You know, but she was looking specifically at a I think it's a Navajo creation myth about the cat people and just sort of like who might be the different players in that creation myth, where what parallels they might have. You know, I would expect of Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan, who are so conscientious about dropping literary references in, that if they're going to have a whole episode dedicated to Ghost Nation, which is admittedly a made-up Native culture, that they would have looked into creation myths from, you know, because there's a lot of talk about a new world, the old world, the wrong world, a new species, the dawn of a new era. Like, it feels like this is... different characters have different ideas of what the new world will look like, but a lot of them are striving for a new world. And so it's worthwhile just looking into some of these different mythological traditions for fun, you know?
Yeah. You know, another a movie that made me think of this a lot recently was the Darren Aronofsky film Mother, if you've ever
seen that. Yeah, I did.
This idea, like, I want to be careful not to spoil that movie, but I think, like, one of the ideas put forward in that film is... the concept that God has created and destroyed the world like countless times in the past, you know,
right.
I think that's like a really fascinating idea, or, you know, similar to like the Matrix, right? Like the idea that there's been like many matrices in the past and like, you know, I just find that to be completely
Battlestar Galactica.
There you go. Yeah. I find it to be completely fascinating. And, certainly the hosts being on these loops and like them having like lived all these lives countless times, it really does kind of feed into that kind of myth. So,
yeah, I felt like in season one, I was often quoting Battlestar Galactica, which has this great quote, "All this has happened before and will happen again." And, that is Battlestar, right? I'm not crazy. And, so when we got Dolores waking up in season one, and we saw her do it twice because we didn't know we were watching two timelines smooshed together, unless we were Redditors, then, you know, that is something that, you know, it's an awakening of Dolores, a sort of Eve biting the apple thing that happened at least twice in her lifetime. But who's to say how many times some other things might have happened?
Yeah, indeed. Well, thanks to Suzanne for writing into decodingwestworld@gmail.com. There's also an email from Laura G, who wrote into decodingwestworld@gmail.com, right? First of all, Laura brings up an issue that several people had, which was, like, there was a scene, I think, in last week's episode where a tech explains to Hale how the mesh network works, I think, right? And I think a lot of people had problems with that because they're like, why wouldn't Hale know about that? It feels, like, implausible and kind of bad writing. Surprisingly, that was something that didn't bother me. You know, I just feel like this show has a ton of exposition that it needs to get out, and it's got to do it in whatever, you know, it's got to use every trick in the book to get it out, including monologuing or characters not knowing stuff. And so I was pretty sympathetic to that. Laura also had some other thoughts about Forge, and I think you wanted to bring that up, right?
Yeah, we find out in this episode that we'll get to this when we get into the meat of the episode, but we already went into the cradle earlier this season, and we find out that there's a counterpart for the cradle across the park called the Forge. It's sort of the name for the server farm that we've been learning a little bit about, that where all the human consciousness is stored. It's called the Forge, which is an annoying thing to call it because it sounds too much like Ford. But anyway, it's called the Forge with a G-E. And Laura writes in, she says, by the way, Forge is an open source software platform that's used in development, analytics, source code storage, etc. They're probably using Linux for their mesh. She says, means Delos. Delos is probably using Linux for their mesh, and this works great with that. Forge analysis is used a lot in genetics, and you can use Forge to 3D print. And then she concludes, when it comes to naming all the text, starting with the use of the word host, the show is very literal, which is great for trying to predict where the show is going to go. So if you want to look into the Forge, which is the pre-existing in our universe open source software platform, and think about what genetics and 3D printing might have to do with what we're going to see in the finale, that is something that you can do.
Awesome. Well, thanks for all the emails to decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Really appreciate it. So why don't we dive into this week's episode again? It's called Vanishing Point, and there's just a few plot lines to discuss, right? There's one big one with William and the Men in Black. Big revelations there with William and the Men in Black. And then the other ones are kind of like a little bit less stuff happens with them. But let's dive into those first. Maeve and Bernard and Ford and Elsie. Talk about all the stuff that goes on with them. So we're back in the Mesa, right? And Bernard heads downstairs and sees Charlotte and Tech testing Clementine, who has Maeve's code implanted inside of her. And she's kind of instructed to deliver a payload through the mesh network. And there's a scene where, like, Clementine, like, kind of puts her hand on the glass and deploys this code, and all the people start fighting. And so this takes place in the past because it's before Charlotte knows that Bernard is a host, right?
Correct. Yes.
And so then we understand Charlotte's going to use Clementine to destroy the hosts. So what did you think of this scene? Pretty. I would say what I would use to describe a lot of this episode is very theatrical, you know. It's very theatrical and kind of over the top scene, and in this case I thought it really worked. You know, you could predict exactly what was going to happen, but it's still pretty well done with all the hosts killing themselves. Your thoughts on how this played out?
Yeah, I thought it was really beautiful. The way it sort of reflects, you know, we already saw Clementine used as a scapegoat for Charlotte's machinations in season one, when she like implanted that fake buggy code in her and had her kill a dude basically in one of those exam rooms. And so here she is again, and once again, a pawn for Charlotte. I really like Angela Serafian. I really liked her performance here. It is theatrical, but I just really liked all the shots of like her putting her hand up in the glass, the way she did it. You know, she's had to do so much work this season without any words, you know, because Clementine hasn't spoken since she got lobotomized. I believe that's correct. And so, you know, I think she's been really effective. I mean, she's got this amazing face, these amazing eyes. Like, they're all very expressive, but I think she's done a lot of really good work in that department. And it's really perturbing. You know, I did speak to this actress for my other podcast, Still Watching Westworld, and Angela Serafian said that she pointed out that, like, now Maeve and Clementine are two opposite ends of the same spectrum, meaning they have the same powers. And, you know, Clementine's being used as a weapon, and Maeve, presuming she gets up off that table, is sort of a defense. And, you know, the way she talked about that, like, she didn't spoil anything, but I was just sort of like, well, crap, these women are going to fight, aren't they, in the finale? And that's going to be really sad. I mean, like, it's just a hypothesis, but that's really sad to me because, you know, Maeve thinks of Clementine as a daughter to her. And for Charlotte to weaponize, you know, someone who's so important to Maeve against her is really extra tragic. And like, I sort of like went down the rabbit hole thinking about all the ways in which the show has been telegraphing this, like the fact that, Maeve already killed a version of Clementine in season one. She killed the blonde woman who replaced Clementine in the saloon back in season one. And then also we saw Sakura, who is a Clementine sort of counterpart in Shogun World, die, much to the consternation of her Maeve, Akane. And so I just feel like this whole like Clementine goes out and it's really tragic has been telegraphed. And, you know, that's something that I think could be very poignant in the finale if it indeed plays out that way.
Mm. Well said, Joanna. And yeah, I thought this Clementine, the actress who plays her, she's been awesome this season, I think. Mm-hmm. It's just really difficult to act without being able to say any lines, you know? And
yeah.
I think any actor who's able to do that effectively gets a ton of points in my book, and she did a great job. So do we have any theories as to why like Bernard was not affected by this? Maybe he just wasn't close enough, right?
I think what we've seen with Maeve is that she can't control people who are woke. It's just the show hasn't done a really good job of defining what exactly is woke and what isn't. Like the fact that Maeve couldn't quite control Lawrence, she could kind of, but not fully, because he was kind of awake. So it's sort of, I think, degree of wokeness, you know. So I don't expect that either Maeve or Clementine could control Dolores, for example. But what would they do with like an Abernathy or an Armistice or something like that? I don't know the answer.
So. I almost read it as like it was a proximity thing. Like they had to be in a certain, you know.
That's also true.
Angle, yes. Like angle of, you know, line of sight to the character, you know.
That's also true. The proximity of the mesh network is also part of it. But Bernard was awfully close. And I think also there is some imperviousness to this influence. So those two factors.
So there is a scene where Ford and Maeve have a conversation, right? Maeve's still splayed out on the table, and Ford kind of does his monologue-y thing, which Anthony Hopkins is so great at doing. And then at the end of that conversation, he gives her even more powers, right?
It's okay for me to talk about like interviews that Jonathan Nolan gave after the episode, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I also thought he gave her more powers, and maybe it even says that in the show notes. What Jonathan Nolan clarified is that he just restored the power she already had that they stripped from her.
I see. Interesting. Okay.
So we see the tablet say unlocking core permissions, and I thought that meant she could do something even I'm like, is she going to fly? What's she going to do? Like, I don't know.
And then
Jonathan Nolan's like, no, she just has her old powers back again.
Okay. I actually read a recap that that kind of said it the way that I just explained it. So I think that is like a somewhat confusing
moment. I wrote it in my recap too. I definitely thought that that's what was happening, and then I watched the behind the scenes and I was like, oh well, all right.
there is a behind the scenes about like there's a featurette about Maeve's neck.
It
was just like about how they did the makeup of Maeve's neck, which I thought is really interesting. In special effects, it can be. You typically see stuff that is additive, like they add stuff, you know, to a person's body. It's much more difficult to do something that's subtractive, which is what they do with her neck. Like it makes it look like her neck's cut open, and that they have like these. You can see the kind of ligaments and the tendons and all that stuff. And I think it's pretty convincing. Pretty convincing, you know. So Maeve has been like had her neck opened up the last guy and she's had to do a lot of acting too, you know, with just that. And I think she's done a pretty good job. Any other thoughts on this Ford monologue with Maeve?
No, it's just kind of amazing to me. Well, first of all, I thought Anthony Hopkins did an amazing, like a really incredible job with it. He's very,
amazing job. I'm sorry. That's my bad.
Though I will say, you know, we were talking about portmanteaus for what we would call Bernard, Arnold, and Ford together, right?
Yep.
But obviously, like Ford and Maeve together, that's fave, right? Like,
yeah. No question.
Our problematic fave. But
you mean it's not Mord? Okay.
Mord. Okay. All right. But the I think this is maybe the most emotional, actually, that we've seen Ford ever talking about Dolores as his child. You know, and it's sort of something that they didn't lay a lot of track for.
Yeah.
But you know, he did, you know, in theory, give her a lot of, you know, permission in season one. So like, you know, his favoritism was sort of there, even though it wasn't explicitly stated in season one. And then we also found out that he definitely wanted her to leave.
Yeah. That was a surprise to me.
Yeah.
That was a surprise to me. I thought his whole plan was to have her go back to the park and like, you know, mess things up. But he explains here that he wanted her to go, and that she was unable to like overcome her programming to go, you know? Or to stay, however you want to think of it. So I did think that was kind of interesting. Because I think, like, when season one finale and season two happened, like, I thought that Maeve was somehow triggering all the stuff that was going wrong in the park. But it turns out that, like, Ford was actually doing all that. And Maeve was just a player in the game. But he does say, she's his favorite host. Which, it, like you said, not that much track laid for that, but it is plausible based on what's happened.
Someone in the chat room pointed out that I accidentally said Dolores instead of Maeve up there, but I hope you guys all know what I meant, which is that Maeve is his favorite, and obviously Dolores is Arnold's favorite. So
yeah.
That's kind of interesting, because then there's like a whole
rivalry kind of
two
thing.
Favorite children. You know, like I've always thought of Dolores is so elevated, but like if Maeve is the other creator's favorite child, you know. And there was a lot of talk earlier in the season, because there's some quotations from East of Eden used in the series. And so, you know, some people are thinking of like, are Maeve and Dolores Cain and Abel? So this idea that they're both favorite children maybe feeds into that whole idea of the Cain and Abel story, possibly. I don't know. But
for those who don't know, Cain and Abel, obviously part of the Christian creation myth, where Cain and Abel were Adam and Eve's children. And one of them was very beloved by God and their parents, and the other one was not as beloved. Cain was the one who's not beloved. And in a fit of pique, Cain murders Abel. Cain murders Abel because he's not his favorite by God.
A real hissy fit.
Yeah. Has a little bit of a bad day, a bad hair. He had a case of the Mondays and murdered his brother.
And then East of Eden is Steinbeck's retelling of the Cain and Abel story. And so, this idea that like, you know, Ford loves to quote everything, but, quoting East of Eden, is an interesting choice. So. Mm.
All right. So, then Bernard, wants to find Elsie, wants to figure out what she's doing. And, he finds her. And Elsie is trying to, like, she's getting weapons from people, and then they have this, like, pretty cool, tense confrontation where Ford's telling Bernard what to do. He's like, you can't trust her, and Bernard tries to remove Ford from his programming, and he, like, kind of wires into his arm, it's this, like, data package removed or something like that, so... Do we interpret that to mean that Bernard is successful at removing Ford?
I don't think so.
No?
No.
Because it says data removal successful or something like that, and immediately after that, Ford's gone, right?
Sure, so. But I wouldn't trust Ford. Someone in the chat room, I think it's our friend Ryan, says that like he thought Ford was lying to Maeve. I don't think he's lying to Maeve, but I do think he's lying all the time to Bernard, actually. This is part of the whole like make Bernard suffer to wake him up, which is something that he said at the end of season one. He keeps saying to Bernard, she'll betray you. It's in her nature, about Elsie, which is just hilarious. Cause like, when you say someone, whenever someone says it's in her nature, it's in their nature, that I think of the myth of the scorpion and the frog, right? The fable of the scorpion and the frog, which is that like, you know, I think it's a scorpion and frog, right? The frog is swimming across the river. Scorpion's like, hey, can I have a ride? Frog's like, hell no, you're going to sting me. Scorpion's like, no, bro, we're cool. I just need a ride. I'm not going to sting you. He gets on his back. They start swimming, and the scorpion stings him. And the frog goes, what the hell? And the scorpion goes, sorry, it's in my nature.
New podcast pitch. Joanna retells Aesop's Fables. Think about it.
Well, what's funny to me is like Ford keeps saying this about Elsie, but of course it's Bernard who keep like Bernard's the scorpion in the story and Elsie's the poor frog, you know, like Bernard betrayed her in season one. And then he's like, help me out. And she's like, no, remember the bucket and the protein bars? And he's like, no, it's fine. Come on, just help me out. It'll be fine. I won't hurt you. And she's like, okay, don't lie to me. Then he leaves her on the side of the road and Shannon Woodward, who plays Elsie, is just like crying. And I'm like, sorry, Elsie, man, it's in his nature. He's a scorpion. Don't trust him. So
indeed. But he does take mercy on Elsie. He doesn't kill her. He doesn't hurt her. Leaves her behind with this kind of homing device that's never introduced until this episode, as far as I know, right? Like this white.
We see it elsewhere, like in Emily Williams stuff. They also have it. But yes, it looks to me like the thing you get at the Olive Garden when they want to tell you when your table's ready.
When your table's ready, yeah. And probably equally as effective, or probably equally as much technology based on how well the QA has been doing with the park. I don't know. I think Elsie's going to survive, but it does feel pretty rough to leave her in the middle of this pretty dangerous environment with a Olive Garden beeper to save her. Anyway.
But But Never Ending Breadsticks are on their way.
Yeah.
So it'll be fine. And then, I mean, I think we already covered what the Forge is, but that's part of the Bernard L.C. plotline, is he sort of, there is some exposition about what the Forge is. Does it feel clear to you what it is?
I mean, it feels clear to me because you've explained it to me on this podcast.
Okay.
You know, so...
A lot of people are heading that way. I believe it's like synonymous with the Valley Beyond, and also like the door. The door, the Valley Beyond, the Forge, it's all like sort of a very similar locale and at least connected concepts. So I expect, you know, we'll see. Now, I mean, I don't know. Just introducing like the new name of a thing in the penultimate episode of the season. I don't know. But, you know, it's possible we will see some more Cradle-like action in the future.
So it's where all the like human consciousnesses are stored theoretically, right? Or
right. Yeah. It's the big server farm that Akichita saw in last week's episode, the Forge. So
all signs pointing to the Forge is where like the big confrontation next week will happen. Mm-hmm. We'll see if that plays out. One other thing before we a couple other things to point out about this scene with Bernard and Elsie. First of all, I really loved the moment where Jeffrey Wright says, "Get out of my fucking head," which I thought was like the most emotional we've seen Bernard in the entire series up to this point. Like he's so tired of Ford telling him what to do, and just like this guttural, you know, elemental expression of frustration occurs, and I thought it was a pretty great piece of acting by Jeffrey Wright.
I talked to Jeffrey Wright a couple weeks ago, and for a different episode, obviously, but like I had already seen this episode, and so I was like, "Hey man, you know, I'm not going to write about this, but oh my God, that part where you say that thing," he's like, "Oh, I know. It was like 2 years in the making. It's so satisfying."
Yeah. Yeah.
Very satisfying.
Great.
Yeah,
it was very satisfying. I agree. Yeah. Okay. And then the other thing is Bernard cuts his arm open to like wire into his system to remove Ford. And that like cutting your right arm open and plugging a wire into it has become kind of Westworld shorthand for
I'm a host,
right, exactly, or this is where the host, you know, this is how you access the host programming, that kind of thing. So just keep that in mind, listeners, because I have a feeling it's going to come back into play later this episode.
I don't know what on earth you could be talking about.
Anything else about Bernard, May, Ford, Elsie before we move on?
I think that's it.
Yeah, that covers it. Okay, so Dolores and Teddy. Dolores and Teddy encounter Ghost Nation at the beginning of this episode. We see Ghost Nation call her the Deathbringer, and they say like the Valley Beyond is not meant for her. So it's kind of a reversal where she's being told she can't go somewhere now. But she says like it's meant for the people who built this place, but she's going to use it against them. Dolores is going to use the Valley Beyond against the people who built this place. So they have like this fight, and they gun down a bunch of Ghost Nation, but then I believe Teddy spares Akichita's second in command, right? Like he sees that person and he can't bring himself to kill him.
Right.
What do you think that is? What do you think that is, Joanna?
I think it's in Teddy's nature. Yeah. He is whatever the opposite of a scorpion is.
Yeah. He can't kill people.
Yeah. I mean, it's exactly what he did with Craddock several episodes ago.
Yeah. But that Dolores was before.
I know. But I'm just saying, like, maybe, you know, you can't fight your original programming to a certain extent.
Indeed. So then at the last scene of the episode is Teddy and Dolores hanging out. And Teddy's really seems really torn up about this whole "you've reprogrammed my entire personality" thing, and gets pretty angsty about it, let's just be honest. Like he's not happy about it, and they have
would you say that he has a case of the Mondays?
This scene, and he's like I'm gonna be in love with you, I'm gonna protect you for as long as I'm still alive, and then he like kills himself, and it is kind of made to be this tragic scene. What did you think of this? I mean, I do like the idea of it being this tragic thing of he can't live with himself now that he's this new person. I like that idea. But again, the word I'd use to describe this is just like very theatrical and not necessarily in a good way. Like I felt like I could predict the ending of the scene, you know, 5 minutes before it happened.
I
feel like
there's agree.
I'm sorry, what?
I agree.
Yeah, like there's a way to play this scene that's like more subtle and less over the top.
I don't think there is a way to play this scene to get the desired effect that they wanted, because and I've said this elsewhere, like written about it, talked about it, but like I just think that the show never did a good job of ever selling Teddy as a character that we're terribly emotionally invested in. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's James Marsden's fault, because I think James Marsden is an incredible performer. There's just something about Teddy that he was like just kind of a good guy cipher for most of it, and then like bad for exactly two episodes, but you know, so like a little bit more interesting, but you know, not much more.
He seemed mildly tortured by it. And, is how I describe it.
Well, the other problem is I think the show never really sold me on the Teddy and Dolores love story. And I think that's because, you know, like I said, I've talked about this elsewhere, but I think that's because in the first season, Teddy's the other guy. And the guy is William, like
right.
Dolores' boyfriend's Teddy. But like when you're watching season one, you're like, oh, no, but we like William, you know, until you don't. But like Teddy's the other guy, the like in the rom-com verse, it's called it's the Baxter character, the Baxter.
He's the guy that, you know, the fiance, you leave the fiance to be with the guy you're really in love with.
Exactly. And so like to then try to bring the Baxter back in season two and make me feel like he's the one, he's supposed to matter in a love relationship with Dolores, never worked for me. Mm. They never really made that work for me in this season. So I am sad to see James Marsden go, because I think this is it for James Marsden. And I'm sad to see him go because I think he's a tremendously good performer. And I think Evan Rachel Wood's performance, her reaction, the shock and the horror from Dolores was actually tremendously good. But like I didn't feel emotionally invested in it. I felt like I was just watching an incredible piece of technical acting from Evan Rachel Wood selling something that I didn't believe.
Yep. Yeah, I feel the same way.
Does that make sense?
I feel the same way. I mean, they try to even amp it up a little bit by having the flashback, right, about how he wakes up in the past, and it's like the first time, and he's like, I remember seeing you. Dolores, by the way, just like chilling in the corner, you know, in the same room, and he's like falls in love with her right there, apparently, you know, just to cement the bond between the two of them, in case you weren't sure of it as a viewer.
I didn't like that when he's like, and you looked cold, and I'm like, oh, come on. Though I really did like the like love struck look on Marsden's face.
Yeah, that was nice. Yeah.
I thought it was really good. People in the chat room are pointing out that Marsden has played this character in a number of films: The Notebook, one might say Cyclops in X-Men,
mm-hmm.
and The Prince and Enchanted. Mm. So, you know, we'll just like, if you're feeling like you need justice for James Marsden, then please go watch 28 Dresses, where, spoiler alert, he's the opposite of the Baxter. Mm. So, you know, watch that rom-com classic. Actually, Marsden's really good at that.
Is that
movie.
The sequel to 27 Dresses, Joanna?
Okay, fine. 27 Dresses. Thank you. 28 Dresses later.
It's, I think, actually, Two Dresses, Two Furious is what I think you're referring to.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay, so Teddy executes himself, and it is very sad and very tragic, even though Joanna and I didn't quite feel anything. But it's nice. It's nice for Teddy because he can finally be at peace and in a deep sleep, which, by the way, is something that you can get with the help of our sponsor today, Casper Mattresses.
What a beautiful... Wow, that's beautiful.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Yeah. So I have a Casper mattress. Uh-huh. And I'm just here to tell you, Dave Chen, that I've had it for a number of years. It has changed my life immeasurably, because it has this multiple supportive memory foam layers for quality sleep surface and just the right amount of sink and bounce.
Mm. I also have a Casper mattress. First of all, let's just say, like... you know, many people out there don't get a good night's sleep. Casper mattress helps you to do that, and it does so in a very delightful fashion. I mean, we both sleep on Casper mattresses. When you get the mattress, it comes in this box.
Yeah.
That, like, you're like, how could a mattress possibly fit in here? It's impossible.
There's no mattress in that box.
There's no way. And you open it up, and basically you cut open this this wrapping, and then the mattress just unfurls before you. You know, it's pretty amazing. And that amount of thought that goes into the unboxing experience also goes into the experience of using it. Casper products are cleverly designed to mimic human curves, providing supportive comfort for all kinds of bodies. Everyone spends one-third of their life sleeping, so you should be comfortable when you do that. And the experts at Casper work tirelessly to make a quality sleep surface that cradles your natural geometry in all the right places. It cradles.
Ooh.
Cradles. Like,
is that cradle with a CR4-DL?
That's like right. It cradles very much like the cradle in Westworld holds, you know, all the personalities of the hosts.
Yeah. Casper mattresses come at an affordable prices because Casper cuts out the middlemen and sells directly to you. And they've got three different models of mattresses. They've got the original, the Wave, which features a patent-pending premium support system to mirror the natural shape of your body, and the Essential, which has a streamlined design at a price that won't keep you up at night.
Mm. Which mattress do you sleep on? I prefer the original myself. I'm an original Casper fan.
Just like Dolores is an original host, we are both original Casper mattress owners, Dave Chen.
Well, we've spent time talking about how awesome Casper is, but do we have some kind of deal for our listeners?
Listen, our listeners are in for a treat. You can get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/decoding using promo code decoding at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. That's $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/decoding and using promo code decoding at checkout.
Thanks to Casper for sponsoring us for this week's episode of the show. All right, so let's move on with the rest of this episode. And there is so much to dive into here, Joanna. We basically have like a lot more about the William and Emily storyline. Like this is like the bulk of the episode, right? Is what's going on with William and the Man in Black and Emily. The episode begins. First of all, we should also point out that, like many of the last few episodes, these previously on Westworld previews are like really effective. You know, often wordless. You know, just highlighting the main moments from the series. I'm a big fan of how they've been doing the previously on.
Chef's kiss.
Yes, agreed. And so there's this kind of like monologue at the beginning of this episode, right? Where like we see William, we hear William talking, and we see a bunch of like random imagery. He says like, this thing in me, even I didn't see it at first, and then one day it was there, a stain. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized I couldn't remember a time it wasn't there. And we see like random shots from the episode and like William holding a gun to his head. Anything that you want to say about that montage before we move on to what's going on here?
I love it. I mean, like you and I, we have different opinions on the episode, but like all the stuff we just talked about is interesting, but this, I think, is the artistry of the episode, which is the way the Juliet story unfolds. I really loved it. I love the way in which dialogue and monologue are pulled from the middle and the end of the story and used at the beginning. I love that you see things and you don't know exactly what you're looking at until you see it in context later. Again, that sort of like looping, repetitive unveiling of what happened with Juliet. You know, and this is obviously like something that we've had a lot of questions about this season. What happened to Juliet? And we have many, many emails to prove it that people were curious. And so I really like the way the episode delivered this. And like, most importantly, you know, I brought this up on the podcast that like I was concerned that that Juliet wouldn't like be able to be that important to the story because, you know, the actress playing her was this model that they like happened to have in a stock photo in season one. And I was like, I don't know if she can act, blah, blah. And a couple people wrote it and they were like, well, couldn't they just cast an older actress? And I was in my head, I was like, well, wouldn't we know? But you know, they've hidden a couple casting surprises this season, I should say. And they hid Cela Ward. Amazing. I love her. And as soon as she showed up in the, I know you don't necessarily watch the Next Time Ons, but yeah. I watched them and she showed up in the Next Time On last week. And even though they didn't say in the trailer who it was, I was like, oh, they got Cela Ward and she's definitely Juliet. She's got to be. And then sort of like some news, like it was revealed that she was, but I was just like, as soon as I saw her, I was like, well, of course, yes. Cela Ward, Juliet. Great. I'm ready. I'm ready for the Juliet story. Bring it. So huge, huge, huge deal.
I mean,
for me.
Here's a fact. Indisputable fact is Cela Ward does not get enough work. You know, like I think she's an amazing actor, and every time she's in something, I'm like, this is an incredibly charismatic, compelling presence. And I just, you know, love her in everything except for Independence Day Resurgence, which I thought was a terrible film. But in general, every time I see her, I'm always delighted because she's awesome. I really liked her performance in Gone Girl, for instance. So it was great to see her appear as Juliet. So there's a scene that takes place at this kind of gala, and there's all this stuff about this big benefit that, you know, William is responsible for and stuff. And we finally see William and Emily interact outside the context of the park, which I thought was really fascinating. Like, mm-hmm. It's fascinating when you see these two characters. And the entire universe in which you've seen them has been in one context, and you finally see them in another context. I just find that inherently interesting to see, like, the different sides of people when they're in different environments. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
And just to even see her out of the park at all,
Yeah.
In like, rich philanthropist daughter mode was intriguing.
Yeah. Because I feel like the show spends a lot of time with these characters monologuing about their lives before they got to the park. And so it's always interesting to see, like, that play out for real, and like, oh, this is in fact real, and like there was a life outside of the park, and I like how that's brought to life here. So prior to him meeting up with Ford, is there anything you want to say about this whole interaction at the charity ball?
I mean, we get a reminder of William's, like, love of books, and this thing that he has in common with Juliet. We get this flash of Dolores, and this is something that I wanted to bring up with you. And, like, I don't usually like to sort of relitigate disagreements that we've had, on the podcast, but this is one I do want to relitigate a little bit, which is, like, when we watched episode, four, which was Riddle of the Sphinx, and we saw that scene where William, as played by Jimmy Simpson, is interrogating a naked Dolores, talking to her about his plans. And I was asking, I was like, what do you think his motivation is? And like, it was your opinion at that time that William was, like, completely over Dolores and she meant nothing to him, and that he was now focused on the scientific endeavor. And I disagreed with you, and I said, I think Dolores is the drive for everything that William does. He's obsessed with her forever. And I think this moment, at least, and certainly the episode as a whole, bears that out. That, like, he had this other idea, but this other idea, I think, was in service of this obsession that he has with Dolores. So
I think you're right. I can give you that one, Joanna. I think you're right that, like, that is the direction that this not even necessarily interaction like Dolores herself, but like Dolores's role in his life is something that he's been obsessed with, and I think that this episode certainly bears that out. So so then William has an encounter with Ford, right? At the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, so exciting that they have a chance to meet again.
I know. They were giving you exactly what you wanted.
Right.
Which is more, yeah. Oh, but you didn't like it.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't as much of a fan of this particular interaction. I mean, they're like I said, the episode is very theatrical, and he's like, we're going to do one final game, you know.
That's a terrible line.
One final game. And
okay,
it's like,
okay,
yeah, go ahead.
That was a terrible line. A terrible line and poorly delivered. Like, I'm on record as saying Anthony Hopkins could read the phone book and I'd be interested. We found the exception. We found, like, the one line Anthony Hopkins can't deliver. And it's like all of his dialogue in Mission Impossible 2 and then, like, this one line right here. It's terrible. but I thought the rest of the interaction was really good, you know?
I think in the Slash Filmcast Slack, someone had said something like, they were imagining, like, he's like, one final game, William. And then, like, the bartender's like, I'm sorry, what'd you say? And he's like, oh, sorry, I thought no one was listening. I was just intoning something ominously in William's absence. It is very kind of it like kind of rips you out of the reality of the show in some ways. But any comments on this interaction between the two of them? I mean, it's basically Ford saying, like, you know, other than warning him about this one final game, it's like, you know, you're going to find that, like the stuff you learn is not stuff you're going to want to learn, and vague warnings about all the stuff that William's undertaking. Anything you wanted to highlight about this scene?
There's this, well, he says something that I think is really intriguing. You know, William says, we have an agreement. You stay out of my project, you stay out of the valley, and I stay out of your stories.
Yeah.
And then Ford says something like, I'm not the one who violated that agreement. You people did. I don't know what that's in reference to. It's possible we haven't figured it out, but I don't know what that's in reference to.
Hmm.
I thought that was interesting. And then also a couple times here and elsewhere, William does this thing where he clutches at his arm in a certain space.
Yeah.
And so that's something, you know, we'll talk about at the end of the episode, but it's something that starts at this party. We see him do it, I think, twice. So
His right hand. I think, was it also this episode that his right hand was like shaking? I think that was like last episode of the episode before, right?
Right.
Where you see a close up and his hand's kind of like shaking as though something's wrong with it. Anyway. So then they go home and they have some more intense confrontations. And William and Juliet gets drunk. Right. And needs to be taken away. And we should also mention that before they go home, like Ford slides him a card that has like all the information of William's adventures on it. Right.
So, yes.
They go home and then like there's a bunch of like recriminations and there's like a bunch of revelations of things. And one of the things that's revealed is that the way that they're reading people's minds is through hats.
All right, now let's go back. Okay, let's go back. Let's talk about some of the good before we get to the stupid hat thing. Okay.
Okay. Sounds good.
You know that, like.
Yep. Continue.
I think everything that Katya Herbers does in all of this is really good. She's being very accusatory of him. She's trying to get to the truth of her mother. That's actually not the case. She knows what happens with her mother. But like all the confrontation, I think, between them is really good. I think, though it's improbable that William's even alive, I think Ed Harris is doing a really good job at like on the verge of death acting and sort of like this coming out of flashback acting. Okay, now you could talk about that.
I mean, Joanna, that the hats is pretty rough, right? I mean, it has to be one of the dumbest reveals in the history of Westworld. This idea that like you have the most advanced technology in the world, like that humankind can barely comprehend at your disposal, and the way you're going to do brain scanning is hats. There's a lot of questions that this raises. This raises more questions than it answers, right? One of the things it raises is, what about the, like, does everyone wear hats? Because I feel like maybe not all the men wear hats, or certainly not all the women wear hats, as far as I can recall. Like, is every woman in the park wearing a hat?
No, and it's certainly not in Shogun World and certainly not in Raj World.
Yeah, and then what about the other parks, right?
I went back and looked at the Raj, and only some of the people are wearing hats. So, like, yeah, no, it's stupid and silly. Ryan in our chat room says, Emily just said she's going to turn her father in, right, so William is incentivized to lie. Ryan, by the way, thinks everyone in this episode's lying. No, she says later. Right here she's saying, I just want to find out what happened to Juliet. I just want in on what you're doing. Tell me what you're doing.
Right, so the episode cuts back and forth between like present day William and Emily, or close to present day William and Emily, and then past William and Emily, right? And so in the present, it's revealed that the scanner's in the hat, and Emily says, I just want in on what you're doing, and so on and so forth, yeah.
And so the hat thing is silly. It's so silly. It's completely silly. But here's what I will say about it. If you went to one of those Westworld immersive experiences that they had at New York Comic Con or at South by Southwest, as I did, every single person and journalist who went into that got a hat. That's something that they give you. You get like a white hat or a black hat when you go in. And I feel like every single person who got one of those is like, ah!
So if you're one of the hundreds out of the millions and millions of Westworld fans that got to experience that, that that was a very shocking moment for you on this episode.
Okay, calm down. Lisa Joy on Reddit, like, months ago said something about, like, I wouldn't trust those hats. That's something that she said on Reddit. Mm. Like, it's just, you know, they have a tendency to do that. I think it's silly and stupid, but I am not mad about it. I, like, laughed about it. I was like, this is so silly and stupid. Let's just roll on.
I guess they're just like, hey, we're going to scan everyone except the people who don't wear hats, and we're willing to take that risk, right?
I don't know.
It just doesn't hold up under even the mildest of scrutiny.
I agree with you.
All right. Okay. I don't need to belabor it any more than I already have. So, okay. So then there is like this, let's just talk about all the William we can't really talk about William in present day without talking about the past William stuff. So let's finish talking about the past William stuff, which is like, essentially, you know, Juliet accuses William of like consuming her family, first her brother and then her father, and now it's me, and kind of alluding to like how William has been a phony and a fake and has done all these crimes to her family. And Emily sees this and is like, hey, you know, maybe we should have Mom committed to an institution. This whole kind of family dynamic plays out this episode. What did you make of all this?
I loved it. You apparently didn't, but like, I really love this, this idea of William as a virus that's eaten through the Delos family. Cause it's kind of true. He calls himself a stain, as you already mentioned, like, you know, we hear it twice, at least in this episode. She calls him a virus. He talks about like a black speck, and when it was there, it was always there. But you know, if you think about the fact that William first, destroyed Logan and then Jim Delos and now her, I think it's all true. And what else is true? The other thing that I like is, you know, we've talked about the film The Prestige before on here, which is a film that Jonathan Nolan wrote. I think of all the Nolan films, all the Christopher Nolan films, and Jonathan Nolan has written on most of them, The Prestige is the most Jonathan Nolan film out of all of them. It's also my favorite. There's a very similar dynamic that plays out with the Rebecca Hall character and her husband, as played by Christian Bale, I will say for simplicity's sake, where she doesn't, she's lied to and gaslit through their whole relationship, and the withholding of love drives her first to substance abuse and then to suicide. I'm okay with spoilers for The Prestige. I'm sorry. I just am. And that's not a major, major, major plot point, but you guys can yell at me if you want to. That's fine. But it's a theme that obviously interests the Nolans. There's a lot of dead wives throughout the Nolan filmography. Juliet is just another one of them. But the idea that someone like that William playing the role of the good guy and lying to her their entire marriage and always being in love with this other woman, but not being introspective enough to admit it to her is such a painful life experience to have this love withheld from you and being told that you're the crazy one. That whole concept really resonates with me. I think it's really, really interesting. So, it works for me.
I think the dynamics work, like the, you know, the way the scene plays out between them, it's totally is great acting, and I enjoyed it for that. I think my beef with the episode, Joanna, is that like these revelations are not particularly interesting, nor do they even feel like revelations. You know, like I don't feel like we learn anything really about William and aka the Men in Black this episode that we didn't already know at the beginning of this episode. Am I wrong about that? Like, do you feel like, oh, well, now we know this about William? You know, like I don't know that there's anything that was. It felt like it was building up to this big moment where you're like, oh my gosh, he was evil all along. And it's like, well, we basically already knew that, you know? And
I don't think it was trying to give us a revelation about that. I think it was trying to give him a revelation about that. you know, which is like, you know, we see him monologuing to her later. So like, obviously he has thought about it somewhat, but he does this crazy thing in this episode that we haven't gotten to that I think really reinforces that for him, like how far his delusion has gone, how paranoid and deluded he's become, and where that all started and the way in which he drove Juliet to that. I agree that there's a lot of this we already knew and a lot of this, plenty of it we could infer.
Yeah.
But I think the way it's done is actually kind of because they didn't do it in a linear fashion, because Westworld never does anything in linear fashion. I like the way that it unfolded. I like the repeating and flashing back and forth. I like that they got Seal Award to do it. And so it does work for me. And it just deepens, I think, our understanding of what exactly William's compulsion is, because you yourself didn't realize maybe how obsessed he was with Dolores in the park and belonging there just a few episodes ago. So like, I think it is something that needed, I'm not trying to hammer that. I'm just saying, I do think it's something that needed underlining in a way.
I think all the stuff with William in the present day, like that stuff really works for me. And last week, I think we talked about how there's often in Westworld, like a large buildup to these big moments that happen in the show. And it's kind of a test of the storytelling. It's like, has the story laid enough track? Is there enough ground laid for this this big moment to happen? And I think all the present day stuff really worked for me. I believed it. I thought it was really effective. It's the past stuff that I'm like, I feel like this is being framed as this big revelation. Like the way it's in episode 9 of the season. If this flashback stuff had happened in like episode 2 of the season, my opinion of it might be quite different. You know. So I just think the language of the show and the way it kind of has this build up and this big moment that he has with the monologue with Celia Ward sleeping, just felt to me like it was hinting at more than we actually got. But all the present day stuff really worked.
Well, I think that we needed it here because it's because of the parallels with the Teddy and Dolores stuff. Mm. Like when we see presumably, and I did want to mention, we don't talk about trailers for the next episode on this podcast. That's not something we do. I've seen it. Dave hasn't. That's just how we choose to consume our media. I did talk about it at length and in detail with Insider's Kim Renfro over on my other podcast, Still Watching Westworld. So if you want me to, like, do you want to hear all my speculation about what's coming in the finale, which I haven't seen yet, that you can get that on the Still Watching Westworld feed. I think it'll be up tomorrow. But to keep it to this episode solely, what we're going to get going into the finale is William having just not only having to reckon with causing his wife to die, and I would blame him for that, but also directly murdering his daughter, and Dolores being responsible for Teddy's death. And so those two things put these two figures on a collision course with each other, having just done like kind of similarly monstrous things. And I think that is why this is here rather than at the beginning of the season.
Fair enough. I mean, I think the William and Emily, William causing Emily's death and the other thing, the Dolores and Teddy, would have still been effective. But, you know, let's just put it this way. I think you're doing a really good job of defending the episode, and I'm you know, warming up to it as a result of everything you're saying. So,
was it because of my recommendation that we all watch 28 Dresses Later?
That's right. That's right. I think it was 28 Dresses Tokyo Drift were recommending. Okay, so William takes the card that Ford gives him and kind of puts it in a copy of Slaughterhouse-5, right?
Yeah.
Which, by the way, for those who don't know, is about that book is about a guy named Billy who becomes unstuck in time, and the story is told in very nonlinear fashion. So I wonder if there's a parallel there.
Also on that nightstand is Jude the Obscure by Thomas Hardy, where there's a suicide and it's a really upsetting suicide in a family and a marriage broken apart. So
I think at the end of Slaughterhouse-5, spoiler for the book, Billy is killed by an assassin using a laser gun. So I'm curious if William's going to get murdered with a laser next week. What do you think, Joanna?
Oh, I wouldn't say no.
I think it's entirely possible. I mean, do we think on a bigger picture level that, like, I don't think William makes it out of the season alive. Right? I think this season is like William's story, And I think it's going to come to an end this season. You have any prediction about that?
I would have said I wasn't sure before this episode. Once he kills Emily, I'm like, that character's done.
Yeah, like there's no, he's completely yeah. irredeemable at this point.
Yeah.
Right? Like, mm-hmm. So like yeah. whatever his arc is, it's probably going to end next week. You have not seen the finale at this point, right?
I have not seen the finale. It's definitely not in the trailer. Like I'm not. This you, not
see William, you don't see William die in the trailer, thankfully.
No. But I think like as soon as he killed Emily, I was like, well, bye, Ed Harris. That's how I felt about that, which is kind of interesting if you think about it. Like, I mean, I don't know if they're going to find room for Anthony Hopkins in season three, but like, you know, he could be ghosting forever throughout all of Westworld. But if Marsden, who I really feel is not coming back, if Marsden and Ed Harris are both gone next season, I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah.
What's going to happen to that cast?
I mean, I will say to the show's credit, it really has gone in wildly different directions this season, even within the season, you know, than season one.
Yeah.
So if they take it in a really different direction in season three, it could be pretty interesting to see. So okay. So what happens in the past is Cela Ward wakes up, looks at the card, sees that William like sees all the stuff that crazy shit that William's done in the park.
Well, also my impression was that she was awake when he was monologuing.
Yeah.
She was awake when he's monologuing and she saw him like he slipped the card into Slaughterhouse 5, but he did it in front of a mirror. Rookie mistake, William.
Yep.
If you're going to hide something from your passed out wife, don't do it in front of a mirror that she can see into. Anyway.
Trust me. Yeah. I wish I knew that lesson 5 days ago.
So, yeah. So she finds the card.
So she finds a card and like opens it up. And at the top left, I'm sure you saw this, but it says subject 002.
Yeah.
Who do you think subject one is, Joanna Robinson?
Or
put it this way. Do you think it is significant that it says subject 002?
Oh, of course. Nothing's insignificant in Westworld. I have two guesses. I can only really share one without talking about the preview. So I will say Jim Dolos, let's say.
Yeah. I think it's very possible, which would imply that William is a host. Yes. That's the implication.
No. No.
How so? Okay, well, let's get to that a little bit later.
Okay.
But any
this is our most fighting episode.
Yeah. Any other comments on this scene where she opens it? Like anything else you want to point out about what she sees on that screen? It's like he has like paranoia or something like that.
Yeah,
in fact, hold on. I think I have a screenshot. I can pull it up. And talk about it. It says Category 47B, occurrence 0.0027%, which is an extremely low percent. And then it says 301.94, persecutory subtype, 296.902, delusions, 301.819, paranoid subtype. Then around it you see like images of William interacting with Dolores and doing all the crazy stuff he does in the park.
Yeah, here's my turn to pick a nit. Are you ready?
Yeah, pick some nits for me.
just one. On that tablet, yeah, we see like little shots of, like we see him that scene from season one where he's like killing everyone with his knife really creepily. We see old William sort of hand Dolores the milk can, and we see him drag Dolores into the barn. Handing her the milk can and dragging her into the barn are things we saw in season one, episode one. Those took place after his wife committed suicide, him handing her the can and dragging her into the barn. I thought that was something that he was just doing in that episode, but it's the same footage. I don't mind them recycling footage. But I guess this just means that William was fond of doing that to Dolores anyway. Like that's the thing that he did when he would go visit the park is, I guess, I don't know, violate her. I mean, like sexually. I mean, because that was the thing is like we see him drag her into the barn in season one, episode one.
Yeah.
And a bunch of TV critics when they saw that, they're like, oh, great. Another rape show. Thanks, HBO. And then what was revealed is that he didn't, I think, sexually assault her in that barn. He was just trying to get information from her. So we're like, oh, OK, never mind. Sorry, our bad. Looks like a sexual assault scene. It wasn't a sexual assault scene. Carry on, Westworld. You have a lot of interesting things to say about women in power. But now that footage is on the tablet, I'm like, okay, well, why does he drag her into the barn all the other times that made it onto the tablet? I don't think it was to interrogate her about the maze. So I don't know why they picked that footage, because to me, I would pick more young William footage of him like smooching her or something like that rather than dragging her into the barn. Though I guess dragging her into the barn reveals, like, the darkness.
His stain. The darkness in his soul. The stain, as it were, you know?
Yeah.
The taint. So, yeah, I find it amusing anytime any show, like, shows footage that has clearly just been taken from the show itself. You know, like, where was the camera? Anyway. Okay, so she sees this, gets really upset, and puts the card in this music box that Emily, we presume, later discovers, right?
Yes. This is a music box that Emily talked about earlier in the episode, so we know that it's something that, like, Juliet bought for her, and then Emily threw it away, and then it seems like Juliet rescued it from the trash, and so she put the card in there, kind of seeming like she knew that Emily would find it there. She wanted Emily to know the truth about
right. But didn't Emily say, like, Juliet had forgotten about it, right? Like, so I guess I don't understand.
No, she said I threw it away in the trash, and then I felt bad about it, and then when I went back, the trash was gone. But that could just mean Juliet found it and took it out of the trash.
I see. Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Yeah, and presumably Emily finds it, and then later on, there's this big scene where, QA people come to save William and Emily, and William is so paranoid that he thinks, like, everyone is part of Ford's game, he thinks Emily's part of Ford's game, and he kills everyone. He just kills everyone. And so the big question is, do you believe that he's so far gone that he would do that? And my answer to that question is yes. I think, like, the show did a pretty good job of conveying William's obsession, and that this seems like a really logical action. And it is a shocking moment, like, gasp-worthy moment when he does it.
When he kills the Delacipor, or when he kills Emily?
Emily specifically, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think they check her spine, right? Am I correct? Like, they check her spine to see if it has the ordinance in it?
His spine gets cleared. You see his spine clear the scanner.
I see.
You don't see her clear the scanner.
Right, that's
but
true.
I don't believe that she's a host, or he's a host.
So he shoots her, and then he discovers the card in her hand, and it's like, oh, only my real daughter could have that card. And before he's about to cut her arm open, which I guess is his way of identifying whether or not someone's a host, right?
Yeah.
And so later on, he's like, he puts the gun to his head, and he has this internal monologue about, were any of these choices truly mine to begin with? Like, have I pretended so long I don't remember who I am, and so on and so forth. And then before he's able to kill himself, he lands on his knees and starts taking out a knife to cut open his arm to prove that he's a host or a human. And your interpretation of the scene was he's definitely a human, right? And what is your evidence for that? Is it that they cleared his spine from the ordinance?
No, I mean, Maeve can clear a spine scan, so, like, that's not necessarily complete proof. I think it's back to from a storytelling perspective. I think this scene doesn't mean anything if he's a host, and I think it means a lot if he's a human who has lost all sense of himself, killing his human daughter. Humans to humans. This is something that I taught. I interviewed the actress Kati Herbers for the podcast. So watching Westworld, she's like, I'm a human, he's a human. She could be lying to me, or that could be what they told her. It's not 100% that, just because she thinks so. But she and I just sort of talked about it, and we agreed that, like, just like how I really needed Ford to actually be dead at the end of season one, which he is, even though he's ghosting this season, like, he did actually die at the end of season one. I needed that to happen for the story. I need this to be two humans for the story. The fact that he's digging into his arm to find out if he's a host is because he wishes he was a host, because he wishes human William didn't do something so monstrous, and wishes he can blame Ford and programming for his actions. But he can't. He's a human. He did that. That's what I firmly believe. Yes.
Well, but again,
I only have to, like, fight about it for a week, and then we'll hopefully know.
Yeah. I mean, it would be a dick move if the show didn't reveal that during next week's episode, like, whether he's a human or not. But I don't know. I'm confident, as you are, I'm sure, that the show will reveal whether or not he's a human on next week's episode. So, as usual, Joanna Robinson, very convincing. I think
the show is supposed to, I mean, he has definitely wondered if he was a host for a long time. That's why we see him clutching his arm sort of throughout the episode. at the cocktail party and stuff like that. That's him like fishing around for that port in his arm. He's thought about it. Like, but this is, I think, part of his delusional paranoia. He wants to be a host because he thinks he belongs in Westworld. He's like, that's where I belong. You know, and he says as much when he's talking to Juliet. He's like, I don't belong in this world. I belong in this other world. And we just flash to him as young William in the park staring at Dolores and stuff like that. Like, this is where he feels like he belongs. And so there's a part of him that wants to be a host because he's like, okay, then I'm where I belong. But he's not. He's a sad, sad human who has just lost himself entirely to his delusions and the immersive fantasy of the park. That, I think, is the story that they're telling. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, everything you're saying is like, wow, like, I guess the show is pretty good. But
well, I understand this is what I want to say to all the people who are like, is Emily a host? Is William a host? Like, I don't blame anyone for wondering that.
The show is clearly setting you up to wonder that, right?
Oh, the show is definitely, I mean, certainly when it comes to William, but like, also, the show like did such a crazy rug pull in season one that if everyone is like as paranoid as William and looking around for the rug pull and they're like, where's the twist?
Right.
Where is it? I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to be in front of it. You're a host. Like, turned us all into Williams, basically. You know, that I don't blame anyone for feeling that way because that's the sort of theorizing that Westworld has encouraged, and it has put everyone off their balance. But I would just encourage people, and like, I could be wrong, you know, I've been wrong before, but I would just encourage everyone to like sort of dig into what is the more satisfying story. Because I think for all the foibles that I would say Westworld has, and I think it has plenty, I think Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy are really, really intelligent storytellers when it comes to human themes. And so I think they would tell the most interesting and emotionally poignant human story. Especially since the Nolans in general are so preoccupied with like the driving force of love and all these sort of things. Like, I feel so strongly that he has to be a human for the story. But that being said, I also do believe there's a big twist coming in the finale. And once again, if you want to hear me talk about that, hear me talking about that on Still Watching Westworld. But I don't think it has anything to do with William as a host. And thank you all for listening to me on my soapbox. I'm done.
All right, let me try. We have not prepared this at all. Like, so I'm just extemporizing here, right?
Sure.
But I think, like, I'm trying to think, like, everything you're saying is right. Like, I'm like, oh my gosh, as usual, Jenna Robinson makes complete sense. Is there a world where William being a host would make this a better story, you know? And this would have to go way back. Like, he would have had to have been a host for quite a while. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so close to being a host that, like, he's indistinguishable from – so indistinguishable from human that there's something – essential about that character that like that is fundamentally William even though he's a host, right? And that like what you're saying is like, wow, that's a really compelling, convenient point about like what the show is trying to say about humanity and being lost in fantasies and like how you shouldn't get lost in fantasies because one day like the fantasy becomes indistinguishable from the reality and that's bad for everyone involved. And, you know, and that's a really interesting conflict that humans have today. And, you know, like all that's interesting. And I'm wondering like, okay, what would be more interesting than that? Like, or as interesting. And, the idea of William, like there is this idea of like, oh, we thought William was a human this entire time, but he was a host. Like there's something even, like somehow the audience was complicit in William's belief that he was human, you know, and that what really separates humans from hosts, and it's like very thin line and not that much, you know, maybe like the show could be trying to make a point in that regard. But I'm really reaching. I'm admittedly
reaching.
No.
I'm hearing you. I'm not ignoring you. I think the show's already made that point with the Bernard story in season one, like on a really minor scale with the Marsden reveal in episode one, season one, because we thought that Teddy was a human and he was a host. And so we're like, okay, so we could be confused and think a human is a host. And that prepared us for the Bernard reveal, which made us question the nature of our reality and question like the line between human and host. And that is consistently the Bernard Picard story is like, what if you thought you were human, but you're a host? And I mean, like, that's true of all the hosts, but like a little bit more true for Bernard because he's been aware of the existence of hosts and that, all that sort of stuff. So I feel like we've done that storyline. And there was a time this season where I thought so too, where I thought maybe William would have to choose between being a human and being a host. Like maybe he's going to encounter a host version of himself in the next episode and he has to choose, like, do I continue to live as a human or do I live as a host? William's rejection of immortality that he saw in the face of Jim Delos, like, seems to me to mean that he is not interested in an artificially prolonged life. And once again, I just do, now that I feel like I understand the William character a little bit more, borne out by a lot of the conversations with Juliet that he had in this episode, now that I feel like I understand what his dysfunction is, I got to stick with the, it's the most interesting if he's human. So,
all
yeah.
Right. All right. Right. I think, I mean, you're saying, like, well, we are, Bernard already made that point. I mean, like, you know, we're watching a season where we had, like, a really extended digression into Shogun world and Ghost Nation world, you know, making points that I feel have already, like, I'm saying, like, the show has been repetitive sometimes. You know, it's not like, oh, the show made a point and therefore it's not making it again. You know what I'm
Absolutely,
saying?
Absolutely, but I just think it'd be really cheap if, like, the big reveal of season one is the same as a big reveal of season two.
Mm. All
and
right,
so
well,
I think them leading us down the path to thinking he's a host and then know the big reveal is actually he's a human and like he's more the monster because he's a human, I think is, yeah, the more interesting story. But, you know, like Westworld, I don't know what happens in the finale. I genuinely don't. I have guesses. I don't know for a fact. I have no spoilers. I have no leaks. I have not seen the episode. So, like, I am with the rest of you guys guessing. I've certainly been wrong plenty of times before, but that's where I'm putting all my money this time. So,
yeah. All right. Well, you have you've convinced me, Joanna. You've convinced me, and I'm being completely serious. So, I mean, 98% convinced me. You know, I still have, like, a tiny bit of doubt, just because I've been hurt so many times by the show. You know, like, you believe one thing, and then the other thing is true, and I'm like, you know what? You can never really trust what you think the show's going to do. So, all right. Overall/closing thoughts on this episode.
Something that we should mention really quickly, lest we get emails about it, is, you know, so they've named the server the Forge. We've also talked about the Valley. Obviously, the Valley Forge is a huge, famous location in you know, the Revolutionary War. So, you know, I don't think that that's an accident. That, you know, possibly there's going to be some kind of battle in the Valley Forge. And anything else? No, I'm really excited for the potential of Maeve to get up off that table. She's been decommissioned for a couple episodes now, and I miss her, so I want her back. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how they're going to tie all the plot lines together. You know, this is like... any season of TV like this is watching a person, like, put a bunch of plates on sticks and start spinning them, and at the end of the day, they all need to kind of converge in an interesting way, or they could all fall to the ground and shatter. So, like, it's a delicate balancing act they're pulling here, and I am very curious how well the season finale will pull off a satisfying ending that ties all these disparate threads together and that makes all the time flashing back and forward makes sense, and so on and so forth. So,
and we should point out, or you know, if that's interesting, is that the finale is 90 minutes, so they got some extra time to do it. You know, there's that.
Should be pretty pretty interesting. So,
where are you? Like, I mean, I don't want to like harp on this, but yeah. I know you liked last week. I know you didn't like this week as much. Overall, are, like, I don't know, where are your expectations? Like, could a really strong finale, like, bring you around and
I think
say
so.
Like, this season was good?
I think I'm there. Yeah. I think we already had a really good conversation last week about some of our frustrations with this season and how The non-linear storytelling like hurts the show in some ways. And you know, I wish they would, as you said last week, I think like trust more in themselves and their abilities as storytellers to like tell the story chronologically. I would assume that at some point there's going to be like a chronological cut of Westworld that tells the story from beginning to end in chronological order. It has been in many ways a frustrating season, but it's also been a season that has so many bold and original ideas, and where the technical elements, right, of the acting, the production design, and so on are so on point that I still think that Westworld's status as event television is very well deserved. You know, so I've been very frustrated with the season, but like ultimately, it's still one of the most interesting things on TV right now. Mm-hmm. I think that the finale, there's a lot riding on the finale. You know, I think like if the finale is not good, it will really sour my impression of this whole season. Because I'm kind of like right on the edge to answer your question. I'm kind of like, yeah, the finale could like, oh, now it all makes sense. Yay. Like, you know, great job. I shouldn't have said all those terrible things on the podcast. That's possible. But
that might be true for Dolores's. I mean, I've been saying terrible things about the right. Dolores story all season, so maybe I'll come around on that. I'm generally higher on the season than you are, and that's fine. But I will say this, one last plug for the finale without talking about the trailer. The trailer got me really excited. So I'm pretty interested to see what's coming.
All right. Well, I'm interested to walk through it with you next week on Decoding Westworld, Joanna. So it should be exciting. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the podcast. Find more episodes at decodingwestworld.com. Email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Joanna Robinson, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at JoeWroteThis.
Find all my stuff on DaveChen.net, Twitter at DaveChensky, that's DaveChenSKY, and YouTube.com/DaveChenSKY. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.